Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Hey, Dad. How you doing?
Good, Tay. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Hanging in there. Good. Preparing for my birthday is tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. It's your birthday eve.
Yeah.
To which
some... It's not a holiday, but, you know.
My birthday's a holiday.
Well, I mean, my birthday eve isn't... That's nothing. That's not a thing.
Well, it is for you, though, and for all who know and love you.
Well, I've got big plans. Big party plans. I'm going to donate blood.
Oh, that sounds like a fun birthday thing.
Yeah, and then probably eat the free cookies that they give you when you donate blood. That's kind of it. That's it.
That's the extent of your birthday plans?
Well, you know, a raging pandemic kind of puts a bit of a wrench in the works.
I was going to say, you need to hire a better party planner if that's all that you got.
I know, just giving blood. I guess I wouldn't want to receive blood. Like, that's not, you know. I'm okay with how that is working out. But.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing you're not a turnip.
It's like a squeezing blood from a turnip thing.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
For lots of reasons, it's a good thing I'm not a turnip. the bleeding factor being the least of them.
Because then whenever you came around, they'd say, we don't know what's going to turnip.
So, hey,
with Tay here, anything could happen.
Well, you know, along with getting older, I was kind of thinking, like, what around aging and this podcast? Is there an episode idea there? And one thing that I landed on that I honestly... You know, sometimes I'm bringing episodes to the table where I know something and I want to share it. But this is stuff that I kind of didn't know. There were lots of questions around this that I didn't have the answers to. Specifically around the idea that our palates mature. You know, it's a commonly held belief. Like, over time, you have a more mature palate. Definitely something I've talked about in relationship with alcohol. That over time, you know, develop an appreciation for more nuanced flavors. You like sweet things less. But is there any scientific basis for that, you know?
Or are we just numbing ourselves to things in life?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably part of it. There's a lot about taste that I have, like, I've been told how it works. I have, like, anecdotal thoughts about it, but I don't really know any of the science behind it. Or, like, you know, this idea of, like, super tasters. That some people are better at tasting than others. Also, like, you know... The like extent of what you're supposed to taste in something like wine. You know, I've always been really fascinated by like sommeliers who will tell you like 50 different flavors in a sip of wine. And it always kind of felt like a weird, like an elaborate, like
superpower.
Yeah, like are we really supposed to taste like hay and melon and sandstone in this Sauvignon Blanc? Is that really all there, or are you just selling me something?
Well, I know somebody that liked to know if it's nutty. Does it taste nutty? I like nutty.
Mom likes nutty and round.
Yeah, nutty and round. And tannins. I hear a lot about tannins. Does it taste, does it have a lot of tannins?
Nutty, round tannins. I think she likes grapes.
Well, you know, she may not have been a super taster, but your mom's mom was a super smeller. She could pick up on any kind of scent anywhere. And of course, smell is a big, goes hand in hand with taste.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. And we'll get into a bit of that, but, You know, so here we're this week on Neat, we're going to get into the science of taste, kind of how it works, how it changes over time, and then some of the sort of is it true or is it a myth about how we taste things. So just to start off, just sort of a baseline, what exactly is taste? Well, I mean, obviously, it's the sensation generated by your taste buds when you put something in your mouth, right?
Yep. It's what you taste, the different things that you experience when you eat or drink something.
Right. And that, of course, comes, that's generated by your taste buds, of which most people have like anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000. Some have more, but they're mainly located in the little bumps called papillae on your tongue, but some also exist in your throat and the roof of your mouth. So each taste bud contains specialized cells that detect different taste stimuli. There are five main stimuli that the tongue picks up on. Those are sour, sweet, salt, bitter, and umami, or sometimes called savory.
Umami.
Yes. Now, these five, they're not just the things we pick up on because they taste nice. It's actually an evolutionary mechanism, a survival mechanism. So our tongues are sort of programmed to hunt out things we need or we need to have information on via the way we taste them. So, like, each of these flavors has, like, nuanced reasons why we have developed to pick up on them. But to sort of simplify, like, sour. Sour often accompanies vitamin C, something that we need. We can't synthesize our own vitamin C. We need it. So we pick up on that taste, right? Umami, or savory. That is often present when essential amino acids are there. So think of, like, a meaty taste. We taste those that telling us that there's essential amino acids there that we also cannot create in our own body. We need them from an exterior source. Salt, sodium. It's the only mineral our bodies crave, and it is incredibly necessary for modulating a bunch of functions in our body, specifically around our brain function. So we need salt. So we pick up on salt, our brains go, good salt, because we need it. And now, sweet, of course, similarly, that represents sugar. That's quick energy. Our bodies crave quick sources of energy. You taste something sweet, your brain extrapolates that as, oh, that's carbohydrates, that's sugar, that's something I can use right away. And then lastly, bitter. Bitter is important because it indicates plant proteins, but more importantly, it's a like kind of a sign of poisons much of the time. So when we taste something very bitter, you know, some of us will have that gag reflex even, and that's because your body is tasting something that is indicating that it might be bad for you, something that's rotten or poisonous. So the reason that our tongues pick up on these flavors, it's not just because it's nice, but because it's providing vital information for our survival.
So like way back in time when the cavemen were running around and, you know, things weren't labeled and stuff like that, they'd pick something up and eat it. And that bitter would tell them, uh-oh, you're in trouble. You better not eat this. Yeah, spit it out quick. So they didn't know any different. So, you know, that was a good indication.
The cavemen would not have liked Malort, I think.
You know? Yeah. Well, Malort is one of those things, I think, that kills your taste buds, and that's how you get to like it, you know?
Maybe it's for if your taste buds are already dead. Or maybe it's just, you know, it makes... I definitely feel like the kind of people I know that love Malort, like, it's anti-survival programming. It's like, this will probably kill me. Tastes good.
Yeah, well, if a caveman drank Malort, he would spit it out and say, you know,
that's probably going to kill me.
This bad. This has bitterness. This bad.
Yes. Now, you know, talking about these flavors, I thought this was interesting. A common misconception related to it is that different areas of your tongue taste these things. So you've got like five little, you know, partitioned off sections on your tongue, and each one is responsible for tasting a different flavor. That is categorically false.
But it's something that most all of us believe, because it wasn't until the 70s that they actually came out and started dispelling that rumor.
Well, and it was definitely in science books that I looked at in the 90s.
You know? Yeah.
It took a while to work its way out of our education system.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of us have probably seen that little diagram of a tongue that's labeled with the different flavors. But that's not, that comes to us. There was a German doctor who did studies on this in like 1901. And the way that they chose to represent his data graphically was in this sort of fanciful tongue diagram. So his data wasn't wrong. He was just kind of understanding that different parts of the tongue for different people will pick up on different flavors more in more concentration. But the way that it was, they chose to represent it was in this just very unuseful visual of this tongue with these little areas on it.
Yeah, I mean, what he was indicating was simply that those areas of the tongue did pick up a little bit better on those flavors, but he also clarified, this is the part they left out, but those differences are minute.
Yes.
So,
and they differ from person to person.
So yeah.
Every one of your taste buds can all, those little cells inside of them, they pick up on every, so every part of your tongue can taste everything. Now, if you've ever, like, taken a sip of wine or a cocktail and allowed it to swirl around on your tongue, you've definitely experienced, well, but it does taste a little different on the front of my tongue than on the back of my tongue. A lot is happening there. For one, yes, different taste buds taste different things, and based on how your specific design of your taste buds is, you will pick up on slight nuances in that. But also, you know, the back of your tongue, not to be gross, but there's a lot of saliva back there that's holding other flavors. You're experiencing, you know, as things warm up in your mouth, other flavors are a little bit more prevalent. So a lot's happening when you swirl that thing on your, that flavor on your tongue. There's a lot more factoring in. You're not experiencing these five kingdoms of taste.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, but that is true. There's a lot of times where there's certain drinks, especially that you have and you drink it and it, you know, you don't really, it's like you taste something after it goes down. You feel it like in the back of your throat or on the back of your tongue after the drink goes down that you didn't really taste while it was in your mouth.
Right. Well, and I mean, a lot of that's just, you know, when you swallow, like there's like flavors that linger more, but that's mm-hmm. less to do with the back of your tongue taste things differently and more to do with that's where they're going to linger, you know?
Well, the other thing too, which I didn't know until we were getting ready for this, is you have taste buds in the roof of your mouth and your throat.
Yeah.
You know, so that's your throat getting its share there. I don't know. Maybe that's where it's coming from. But I didn't know you had taste buds in those parts. I thought it was just your tongue.
Yeah. So yeah. So when we talk about balance in a cocktail, it's not like, oh, no, but what if you drink with the left side of your mouth instead of the right side of your mouth?
It's, yeah.
No, it's all, your whole tongue tastes everything. Everybody has minor differences in how the distribution of your taste buds are. But that is not useful as far as how we talk about flavor in our palates. But while we're on the subject of taste buds, it did make me think about this concept of like super tasters. Have you ever heard of these people, Dad?
Yeah, I have. I mean, it's like you say, it was like a documentary or something that was talking about it. And these guys could taste something and tell you like what six ingredients were in it.
And, you know, there's a bit of, I think, sort of mythical inflation of what exactly a super taster is, because there is science behind these people. You know, it's shorthand for people that have more sensitive palates than the rest of us, but specifically it relates to that ability to pick up on bitterness. These people, there are a couple things that can factor in. It can be genetics. There's a very specific gene that these people tend to have. It can come from a concentration of taste buds. They have more, you know, whereas like the average person might have 5,000 to 10,000, they could have double that.
Mm-hmm.
So they just can taste more, but it's not about like all of the nuances of flavor. It's really just about how much bitterness they pick up on. So really like functional super tasters, they tend to be, it's less about that they have a better flavor experience. It's that they're more adverse to certain bitter flavors. A lot of them won't like certain alcohols, things that are like hoppy beers or tequila, because while a lot of us don't think of vegetal when we drink tequila, if you have a very specific sensitivity to like bitterness that can be found in plants, you'll pick up on that strong vegetal quality in agave, and tequila will taste incredibly bitter to you. You know, they won't necessarily like coffee or like Brussels sprouts or broccoli. Mm-hmm. So it's less of this superpower to like have these nuanced flavor experiences and more of just bitter is very offensive to me. It's very, or to them, it's very powerful.
Well, it's also how your brain works in connection with the sensors in each taste bud, because each taste bud has those five receptors for those five different flavors.
Yeah.
So it's sensing that in that taste bud, then transmitting that to your brain, and your brain is interpreting that. And some people have better connections there with their taste buds and their brains, and it's just working smoother.
Well, a lot of it's learned too. You know, it's we have certain associations with those flavors, and if you have, I mean, taste, smell, and memory are incredibly codependent. So you taste something, it's informed by the smell of it, and then those things work together to reach into memories that you have that allow your brain to decide whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. So there's a lot more to it, but, you know, to the idea, like, do super tasters exist? Absolutely. They genetically exist in the world, but it's more a specific sensitivity to bitterness. There's some theorizing on, like, why. What is the... A lot of this is evolutionary advantage, so what's the evolutionary advantage to being a super taster? And it's interesting because it kind of falls in both directions. In one sense, these people would have been very useful because they might have been able to pick up on more nuanced bitterness that might represent toxins that other people might not pick up on.
Mm-hmm.
But also, because they tend to have very limited diets, there's lots of food that they can't eat, these people also would have not consumed a lot of sources, like readily available sources for a lot of things you need, because the inherent bitterness would have turned them off on it. They tend to have, like, less, you know, au naturel, less of a palate for vegetables, which are important.
So they're pickier eaters.
Yeah, they're very picky. And, you know, in the modern age, that's fine. There's, you know, if you live with readily available food sources. But if we're going back to, once again, hunter-gatherer culture, these people would have, in one sense, maybe been better poison detectors, but in another sense, limited the foods they would have been able to consume. And so in times of scarcity, would they have had an advantage? It's hard to say. Incidentally, there's a higher percentage of these people are AFAB. And this has been, once again, postulated to be that, you know, back in the days of hunter-gatherers, women would have been the gatherers. And so it was more important for them to be able to pick up on that, those bitter toxins, because they would have been tasting, you know, plants and berries and whatever, and they needed to have the better palates. So, interesting idea. It's a theory.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting that, too, that I wonder how many super tasters are also super smellers, because I guess those two things kind of would work hand in hand with that. And it's and then it's like you say, it's all a brain function, and you tie that together with a memory of when you've had that before. And I thought that was interesting. It's like they were, you know, if bitter was meant to warn you about toxins, then why do people like IPAs? Well, you drank it the first time, and maybe you didn't, but you had a pleasant experience. So the next time, you decided, I want to try that again because I enjoyed that experience. And your body is learning that it can drink that, and it's not going to hurt it.
Well, and that really gets into the, you know, the bigger point that I wanted to talk about, which is that idea of, do our palates mature? Do things taste differently over time based on your age? And, you know, the short answer is yes. But there's a lot of really interesting nuances to why. I mean, most simplistically, as children, we do have our most sensitive palates. We are specifically very much adverse to bitterness. And this makes evolutionary sense, because when are we at our weakest? When is a poison berry most likely going to take us down? When we're a little baby.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, that's why kids are so, like, kids that hate Brussels sprouts, you know, that old cliche, like, Brussels sprouts have a lot of bitterness to them. Kids have a lot more sensitivity to bitterness. And this is doubled by the fact that kids also have a much more sensitive taste of, or a sense of smell. When we talk about, I mentioned those five flavors we pick up on, and note that, you know, when we just talk about salt, sweet, bitter, savory, and umami, and
umami.
What am I forgetting? I listened to my... I think you
left out bitter was the only other one, wasn't it? Sweet, well, sour, salty, bitter, and umami.
There we go. Notice that I didn't say things, which when we talk about flavor, we often use things like herbal or floral or medicinal or warm, you know, like baking spice. There are lots of words we use to talk about flavor that fall outside of those initial five things. And that's because a lot of flavor is actually smell. This is true. If you have like a cocktail that, I don't know, maybe has like a sweet rosemary honey in it. If you drink that with like holding your nose, you'll pick up on sweet. You might pick up on some bitter, but that's kind of it. But when you drink it with your full palate open, you know, with your sense of smell available, then you'll pick up on, oh, it's herbal, it's warm, it's earthy. A lot, like our brain has this, or our tongues give us this very basic information, these five flavors, and then our olfactory sense fills in these more nuanced flavors mm-hmm. with the smell. So it's an essential part of taste is smell. And kids have high, like superpower in both categories, specifically warning them against bitterness, but also because they're little babies and they need to grow big human bodies in favor of sugar. Why do kids love sugar? Why will they eat it straight from the bowl? Like, Cooper will.
Because they're programmed to do that because it's instant energy.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this is, you know, in a time of scarcity, any source of like instant, you don't need to process it, you don't need to break it down, you don't need to convert it, carbohydrates, a kid's going to want. It's a problem when we live in a society of abundance because then you have kids that will eat sugar all day because they can. But yeah. This comes from a very basic programming, you know?
Yeah, we found a candy stash down at the foot of Charlie's bed under the cover where she'd been hoarding candy down there to sneak at night after she was put to bed.
That's amazing.
But, you know, there are some researchers that argue there's two other tastes that need to be added to that that are regulars, soapy and metallic.
Well, also fat gets thrown in too, which is, I do think, I mean, I agree with this. I think that those are all specific flavors that you can pick up on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, metallic especially. I mean, like, there's certain, like a soft drink in a can that you can pick up that metallic kind of taste that's in it. And I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. As soon as you drink it, you know what a metallic taste is. Nobody has to give you something and say, here, you taste that? That's metallic.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I believe that too from like, I don't know, back in my meat eating days, I loved things like liver, you know, like mm-hmm. pate. And that mm-hmm. that minerality, that metallic... Mm-hmm. Very specific. And I mean, it also, once again, does represent something your body needs.
It's high in iron.
Yeah. You get mm-hmm. that from offal that you don't necessarily get from other meat sources. So it makes sense that we would pick up on that. Same with fat. Fat is an important source for us to enjoy. And there's a reason why our brains love fat in foods, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with that. And then that's one of those areas where, like, we only understand so much about taste. But yeah, that's... So five that we've got, but probably more.
Yeah. Now, there's some people that try to throw spicy in there, but no. The way that a lot of them describe that is spiciness basically is a chemical short circuit in your taste detectors.
Yeah.
Because these things act on your taste detectors and they just short circuit them and they're kind of fooling you into what you're not really tasting anything. They're just disrupting all your tasting ability.
I've always been fascinated by that because people that say I love the taste of spice, like I love the sensation of spice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's a taste. Like,
yeah.
I guess the scientific agreement is well, no, but it is a sensation.
Now, I've never been much of one for spicy food or hot. You know, I don't mean hot, but I mean spicy hot. I just don't like that, man. It makes my nose run and my eyes water, and it just burns. And even low levels, I like. You know, salt and pepper and garlic and, you know, some things like that, but nothing too much out there.
I feel like I had no sensitivity. I had no ability for spice when I moved to New York, but I've been here long enough that it's like now I like spice. Like I like when my nose is running. I'm like, oh yeah, get it all out. Like just clean it all out. I'm going to just cover this in sriracha and just whatever hot sauce. Like I just need it all. Just cleanse my system. I don't believe in cleanses unless it's like spicy noodles.
Yeah, I won't say I won't eat it, but I don't enjoy it as much. I do not go for spicy food.
Wow. But you know, it's interesting because you'd think you would actually would as we get older that you'd like spicy food because this idea of, well, as we get older, what really do our palates, so we understand that children taste things more sensitively, but like do our palates mature in this idea that we have that you have appreciation for more nuanced flavors. You can pick up on them more. Is this kind of, I think sometimes it's almost like a snobby thing, right? Like, oh, I have a very mature palate. I can appreciate like red wine and nuanced. Is this real?
Well, that reminds me of when I was young. And the first time I drank a beer, I thought, oh, God, this is awful. And I asked an older guy who loved beer. I said, how can you stand this stuff? He says, just drink enough of it. You'll get used to it. And I'm like, oh, so that's the key, huh? Just keep drinking it and you get used to it. And in a way, that's right. After about five beers, they all taste the same, you know?
I mean, after about five beers, most things taste the same. But you're not wrong in that this is the truth behind it, this idea that do our palates really mature? I mean, the answer is yes and no. There are a lot of factors that control our taste preferences, but these biological notions from childhood are often tamped down, not just by the body reaching maturity, and so we need less instant energy. We might that biological urge is saying, like, all the sweetness all the time is a little bit tamped down, but it's really a lot more to do with, like, cultural expectations, experiences, and something that we call habituation. So by that I mean, like, it's common here in, like, you know, American culture. When you're an adult, you start your day with what?
Coffee.
Yeah. And when you're a kid, the first time you try coffee, you're like, oh, this is terrible. It's mm-hmm. bitter, gross, just angry bean water. I don't like this.
Yeah. I went through that at a later age in life because I didn't drink coffee till I was 25. I started to work for the railroad in a trainee program, and we had to travel from spot to spot just listening to these boring railroad old men talk about their boring railroad stuff. And I was sitting there trying to stay awake. And I noticed the people that drank coffee got to get up and walk around the room and get another cup of coffee and stand there and stir it and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, hell, I'm going to start drinking coffee in self-defense just so I can get up and move around. So I started drinking coffee. I couldn't stand it at first. And now I couldn't start my day without it.
Well, so, you know, a lot of people, like, it's this thing that we all see you're supposed to start your day with when you get older. It's a sign of maturity. And especially now with, like, the proliferation of coffee shops, a lot of us will be like, well, I can't drink coffee straight, but I can have a mocha latte. I can have some sugar and some fats in there to go along with the bitterness. So we'll drink it that way. And then over time, it's like, I don't really need that much sugar. I don't really need that much milk. We eventually habituate to the bitter black coffee. Or we stay with whatever we prefer. But in any case, what we're doing biologically is it's exposure therapy. Mm-hmm. Those little things that go off in our brain that go, oh no, bitter, bad. At some point, our brain, after having that coffee a few times, goes, oh, I guess this isn't poison. I guess it's fine. And it stops paying attention to that. It stops sending you those those subconscious signals that this is bad for you. You don't notice the bitterness. And then you start to notice the nuances of flavor beyond that. So
your brain just says, ah, F it. I've been telling him and he still keeps drinking it. I'm not going to say anything else. He'll never learn. He's ignoring me.
It's true. And I mean, you just get used to it. Your brain just stops setting off warning signals and telling you that it's gross and just lets you enjoy it as it is. And the other thing is that smell factor that we talked about, you know, this is psychologically true that smell is deeply tied to memory. Mm-hmm. And so smell informs taste. They work in tandem. And there are intense, like, psychological, like, imprints on flavors when we encounter them regularly. So you have a really good, let's say you have an Aperol spritz on a hot spring day, which can be a little bitter, you know, it can be, or like a Negroni or something. But you have this beautiful memory that's built, that's tied to it. Or a very tannic glass of red wine by a warm fire with, like, a good friend. This link between the smells and the tastes and the memories, they form in your brain and they relate to this pleasurable moment and they create this idea of pleasure around this combination of flavors. So you sort of are programming yourself to enjoy things because you're having them in nice environments, in nice moments, and then it's not killing you with poison. So mm-hmm. it all is working together. So to that end, can you mature your palate? I mean, sort of yes. The more adventurous you are with your palate, the more, you know, good sense memories you tie to flavors from, say, different cultures, you know, you will have that ability to accommodate further adventurousness.
Now, the other part of that, though, is the physical part of it. Because another thing that I learned from this that I didn't know, I guess I should have known this, but I guess I was absent that day in biology class or something, but your taste buds are constantly dying and regenerating.
Yes.
They don't just stay the same the whole time. As you get older, they don't regenerate. Some don't regenerate at all, and the others don't regenerate as fast. So your ability to taste actually is drawing down as you get older. Once you reach 40, they say it's a peak. So I'm well past that age, and you don't regenerate as much. So you don't taste stuff as well as when you're younger.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, that's this idea that old people need bland food is categorically false, because really old people need more flavor.
Yeah.
I get like covering things in salt. If you're an older person, you have a heart condition, that's a bad idea, but
you need,
old people would actually enjoy more flavor. In
you need
flavor,
twice the amount of salt to taste what you were tasting before when you were younger.
Or use some seasonings, use some hot sauce. Like that's going to open things up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. So we do, I mean, that's just more like, it's not like your sugar sensors die off and then you taste bitter better. It's all of your taste buds.
Right.
Just as much as every other cell in our body stops regenerating at some point, your taste buds stop regenerating.
Yeah, because it's a taste bud has all five receptors. So if your buds aren't regenerating, that's all five of them that are coming down at the same level.
Well, and you know, there's also, I don't want to like skip also, like there's a lot of culture. I mean, we talked about this sort of idea of like, well, we grow up with coffee, or coffee is an important thing in like our culture. So you acclimate to coffee because you're expected to. But specifically relating to cocktails, I think it's interesting to see how there's almost like there's a timeline development in palate. You know, I came of age, drinking age in New York City during this kind of rebirth of the cocktail culture in New York City. So like a lot of those first cocktails I had when I was 21, 22, I was being exposed to proper old fashions, you know, like proper martinis. And even though I didn't necessarily have a palate for them at the beginning, that's kind of where I started building those associations, pushing my palate. You know, roll the clock back 2 decades, and if I was coming up in the 80s instead, I would have been used to drinks, you know, from a gun, hyper sweet sour mix, you know, like very sweet drinks, and I would maybe not have developed my palate, the habituation that led to my palate that I have now wouldn't have happened. So there is even like an interesting culture shift towards maturing our palates this day and age that we didn't necessarily see. Like even like look at younger generations today that can stomach. I couldn't drink hoppy beer until almost my 30s. Like I didn't have a palate for hops. I thought IPAs were disgusting. And now you've got like 21-year-olds that can tell you about West Coast versus East Coast IPAs.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, in my day, it was like wine coolers were the sweet thing that you drank when you were young. And like Riley's generation drinking dry seltzer instead blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always went with beer just because it was the cheapest back in that day. And I had just enough money each week to buy gas and either beer or cigarettes. So I'm not, that's why I'm not a smoker, because I could only afford the beer. So,
well, but were you drinking like sours and Gozas?
No, you couldn't.
Or were you drinking Budweiser?
Yeah, you couldn't find that. Your choice was Budweiser, Miller, Old Milwaukee, Schlitz, Stroh's. That was it. You know, Coors was a foreign beer. Coors, you couldn't get it unless you got it as an imported beer out of Mexico. That they would import it out of Mexico back into the United States to be east of the Mississippi. Wow. Because Coors was only sold west of the Mississippi when I was that age.
I mean, but it's interesting because I do think it's not just that palates develop in a vacuum. You know, when you're young, you like this. When you're middle-aged, you like this. When you're older, you like this. It's that our culture does play into this.
Mm-hmm.
The way that you grew up drinking is different than the way I grew up drinking, and it's different than the way even just, you know, Riley is growing up exposing her palate. Like, it's completely tied to how our culture has developed and the our expectations of what we should like.
Yeah. Well, you and you're right. The culture you grow up in, because you look at like Thai food or you look at Indian food, things like that, and they're all a lot spicier than most of what you get here. Most of what you get in America is salt and pepper, you know, on it. They always
what part of America?
Right. Well, I'm not saying entirely.
You find some good seasoning down south.
Yeah. Well, I'm not. Yeah. I don't mean entirely.
America, maybe not.
But I'm just saying in general. You know, it's like in other cultures though that you get the spicy food from birth. That's, you know, that's just the way you eat it, and you just eat that, and that's the way it is. Because if you don't eat that, you're going to starve. Because that's what's for dinner.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, but once again, it's those memories. You know, you build those memories from a young age, and then that does it all factors into how you actually physically experience something. That kind of goes back to like that initial question I had about this idea that like can you really taste all that when a sommelier stands in front of you and says, oh, you know, this wine has sandstone melon, honey, and green apple, and hay, and it comes from this small farm where the winemaker, like, three kids tilled the soil with their hand, and this whole story, like, how much of that is just trying to convince me to like something that if I just tried it on its own, I'd be like, meh. Mm-hmm. But then when you look into how biologically taste works, how our brains process taste, that stuff is all actually influencing our enjoyment, our ability to enjoy the thing. Mm-hmm. So it's both like, is it all a lie? Well, yeah, but it's a lie that makes things delicious.
Yeah.
I guess that it kind of comes around to being cool.
Well, you know, when you mentioned the two things that we mentioned for umami flavor was meat and mushrooms. And, you know, I love mushrooms and I love meat. So the first time that I had the chance to eat a non-meat, like they make that jerky out of mushrooms.
Yeah, the shiitake jerky.
And I wanted to try that because, you know, I'm not like you. I eat meat. And yes. But I like to try sometimes to see if I can find something similar to that to improve my diet somewhat. And so I tried that. I thought it was great. And I'm sure that I was getting that umami flavor from the mushrooms, which is kind of what I was expecting, that replaced that same flavor that you get from meat. So it was an easy transition for me to do that.
I mean, that's an interesting way of approaching, like, you know, you're the things that we crave aren't necessarily individual foods. It's more when our body tells us we need something, it's going back to those initial five flavors that generally relate, possibly more, they relate to something our body needs, you know? If I'm like, I love the, oh gosh, what's the brand that makes, like, you know, the voodoo chips, the potato chips?
Mm-mm.
They have a whole bunch of different flavors, but they're just really like salty, like savory, sweet, spicy chips that I love. And when I think when I want a snack, I crave those. But what I'm really craving is I'm craving salt.
Yeah.
What I want is salt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can always be like, well, what do I have in my house that's salty? Because that's probably going to fill the need. But when you understand how tastes work, there is that kind of short circuiting of like, do I really need to like put on my shoes and go to the bodega and get the thing I'm craving, or is there something in my house that is here that I can fill that void with?
I know I can't. I mean, I eat dinner and there's nothing sweet in my dinner, and I'll be sitting there a few hours later on the couch, and I've got to have something sweet. I mean, it can be cookies, it can be cake, it could be ice cream, but I got to have something sweet, you know.
It's an imperfect system that our bodies operate on because it's been around for thousands of years, but it's our body's way of telling us, like, here's this thing I need. Can you get it somehow? Mm-hmm. You know? But I do think that, I don't know. I mean, our biological design is really fascinating to me because the tie, it's not just about flavor. It's not just about how our tongues work. It's how our noses work. And then it's also how the environment we're in when we encounter something, the people we're with, the memories we build. I mean, I think of like It reminds me of one of the first menus I made. One of my best-selling drinks on it was something that I called the Ohio River Road, which you know where the name is.
Mm-hmm.
It's where right. Mom's parents, my grandparents lived. And it had a honeysuckle-infused gin. Honeysuckle grew wild around their house. It had strawberries. They also had wild strawberries there. It had tomato, which is an homage to my grandfather's garden. It had sort of floral bitters. There were a lot of flowers. You know, it had a honey base to the syrup that was kind of warming, and then lemon to kind of round it out. But, you know, it was kind of a weird drink, but it sold really well. And I noticed that the people who I told the story behind it to, like, that was the thing that they would order over and over again. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was my most favorite drink on the menu. And it's funny now when I think of it in terms of the science of taste that, you know, it had the sweetness from strawberry. It had the bitter from the honeysuckle, the floral bitterness. It had that sour lemon. It had, I always add a pinch of salt to my syrups. That's a trade secret, but it opens up the palate. It had tomato, which is actually one of the vegetable sources of umami.
Mm-hmm.
Tomato has an umami
right.
flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an odd occurrence of sense memory actually aligning with an engaged balancing of the flavors of the palate in this drink. But it all worked together to make something that people would order again. And that I personally was like, well, I don't know. I don't know why it's the best drink I've ever made. But for me, this is my favorite drink that I've ever made.
Well, it sounds good just describing it.
Well, but, you know, I mean, it's cool how, like, when we're making drinks, that it doesn't always just have to come from this cold, like, balancing
mm-hmm.
idea. It can also come from, like, the memories, the words, all that stuff that a sommelier will tell you to sell you a bottle of wine. It does actually enhance your experience. It's okay to, you know, lean into it sometimes.
Well, I will say that, like, when we've gone to an upscale restaurant and they give you a cocktail, you know, menu, and it's got their specialty cocktails on it, the ones that kind of tell a story of why they're in the combination they are, those are the ones that you don't look so much at the ingredients as you do at the story and say, that sounds like it would be good. I'd like to try that.
That's true. I think it's, you know, it's all part of the sell, which I think it's fine to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
You know, so, I don't know. There you go. So taste is a nuanced thing. It does change as you get older. It's not just as simple as your tongue experiences different things at different times in your life. There's a whole bunch of other things that factor into it. And also, if you're a picky eater, well, maybe you're a super taster. Not much you can do about that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, maybe you just haven't taken the time to develop those sense memories that will allow you to be more adventurous with your palate.
And if you like Malort, maybe your tongue is flat. You have no taste buds whatsoever.
That's not true.
It's just a slab of meat flapping between your gums.
No, I like Malort. But, you know, also, I like Malort because I worked with a bartender from Chicago, and He was kind of a harsh teacher.
Kind of Malorty.
He was kind of Malorty, but when I did good, he'd give me a shot of Malort, and that was a bonding moment. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what else to say, but, like, I have good memories tied to Malort. And I don't think, it's not like when I try the Malort, my brain goes, remember how good memories are tied to this? No, it just goes, yes, good, because our brains are, that's how they produce things. You know, I enjoy it. Possibly because of my palate, but also possibly because I have good memories tied to it.
Well, I've got to think that as much as diverse as everybody's palate is, everybody always wants me to put together the low country boil when we're on vacation. And I've got to think that it's more the experience of us being together and eating it and all the things that come out of that than it is the actual taste of all the food that's involved.
But I think that's a lot of, I don't think it doesn't, like, lessen the quality of the experience anything. The thing that I really, anyone that's like, oh, well, if the only reason it tastes good is because you have good memories associated to it, or you've been sold on this story, then it's bullshit. It's like, what's in the glass is all that matters, or what's on the plate is all that matters. It's like, no, you can't get around something that tastes bad. We know that. We're programmed to not like something that tastes bad.
Yeah.
But it can enhance the experience of taste to have all those other factors there. And that mm-hmm. is literally part of how we process flavor. So it's not something to look down on. You know, mm-hmm. if you have great memories around, I don't know, like White Claws. Like, that tastes great to you. That's great. That's what
this, well, if you're in college, you probably you're familiar with White Claw memories.
You're probably not like White. That's like me with vanilla vodka and vanilla Coke. Still can't handle the flavor of vanilla because my brain learned no bad poison after like one Halloween.
I like vanilla, but I've never had that combination.
Well, there you go. All right. So there you go. So my palate grew another year older this year.
Well, at least you're not on the downhill slide yet. My palate is 20 some years losing buds. This bud's for you.
Get into hot sauce now then, Dad. I mean, maybe you didn't, how long did you think you didn't like it? Because you didn't like it back when you had a sensitive palate, but maybe now you like some spice.
You don't. It's not to like. It disrupts all your sensors. It short circuits you. You know, and I'm short circuited enough.
Well, that's like intense spice. Like jalapenos have a flavor outside of just hot. You know, there are lots of things that are spicy but also have like a nice flavor to them.
I'll go with the ghost pepper. No, burn out what I got left.
Don't start there. It's like one of the things that will dull your taste buds. We'll kill them off more quickly. Smoking.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because I know so many like very talented chefs that are like, they smoke religiously. So I don't know if maybe they just are more engaged with what remains of their palate. I don't know. You know, like,
well, maybe they have to add lots of extra stuff so they can taste it.
Maybe. And then the rest of us are like, hey, this is nice.
Yeah. And he's like, yeah, I can taste it. It must be okay.
Yeah. Hey, that's it. All right. Well, there you go. Hopefully this was interesting to you. Not specifically about booze, but it's booze adjacent. I really enjoy these episodes the most. I don't know. I don't know about you.
We were kind of like speaking in tongues, huh?
Ha, ha, ha. You know, all this talk of, like, tongues, how they work. I would still never... I ate tongue once in my meat-eating days, and I don't think I would ever do that again. That was one texture. It's not... There's nothing wrong with that texture, but I think I'm not... I don't have good sense memories around eating tongue. How about that?
I'm not eating tongues, tail, or feet. I'm not up for any of those.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. You're missing out on some good flavors there.
That's all right.
Chicken feet, they were pretty good.
You know what? Put that on my headstone.
I can't do the like chewy cartilage. It's a cultural thing, though.
Just put that on my headstone. I didn't eat it, and I missed out. Too bad.
Well, all right. Well, we got you to drink the Lord.
I'm going to hell.
Is that related? I don't know. You didn't try tripe in your lifetime, so right nope. In the furnace for you.
That's right.
That's not true.
He drank Malort. You're going to hell.
Well, that's true, but that's Malort pays for that. That's on the bottle if you look at the fine print.
The road to hell is paved with Malort, and that way the saying goes.
I think they would embrace that. If they thought that they could take that as a catchphrase, they would. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dad. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Taylor, for having me. It's always exciting and interesting, and I'm glad to share in our adventure.
Yes. and thank you all. If you want to find us on anywhere on social media, we're around. We're neatthebooscast@gmail.com. We are neatboozcast on Twitter and Instagram. We have a Patreon. You can check that out. Boozcast. And if you want to talk to other people about how you experience flavor, you can.
On Neat the Boozcast Facebook group. Facebook. On there. We are.
That's it. That's where we are. So check that out. Thank you to everybody who supports the podcast, listens, is part of our Patreon. Thank you so much. All right. Hey, I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And then...
me. The science behind the taste and why everything tastes bland to me. My tongue's dying.
You gotta get your tongue some more exciting things. You gotta make life exciting for the taste buds you got left.
Do it for the tongue. No, that's not a good saying. Let's scratch that.
I'm gonna stop recording now.